You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, July 30th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live
to tape
in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's right, folks. We're not live today because it's vacation week for Sam, Matt, and not technically Michael. Michael is not supposed to be on vacation. He's supposed to be working on office stuff around the office. But it really is a question as to whether or not he's doing that, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Well, look, I'll be putting these shows together and putting videos up, so.
Well, yeah, but you're going to be doing that in advance. Can't you pre-publish those videos?
I could, but...
Well, that's your choice.
That's my choice, yeah.
Michael has no choice. Now, ladies and gentlemen, just because it is vacation week for myself and for Matt, who does not want to take it, and for not for Michael, that does not mean that you're not getting virtually all new material this week. Today on the program, Tom Segrew on the rise and fall of Detroit. Also on the program, Carol Linnett from DeSmog Blog, Canada, on the trade pacts that Canada is signing that are very similar to the TPP and the new trade deals we're negotiating with the European Union. Also, for members today, you will hear from the filmmakers of the film Detropia. This is from the recent, the past year or so, Majority Report archives. Not the deep, deep archives. But that's the show for today. Enjoy it. We'll be back tomorrow with a members show only. And then for you freebies, we will be back on Thursday. If you want to become a member, just head over to majority.fm and become a member. It is your support that makes this show possible, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, so sit back. Enjoy my vacation. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Thomas Segrew. He is a professor of history and sociology at University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program, Thomas.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be here.
So, Tom, you've written a piece in the New Yorker magazine, basically telling a story of your personal experience, but also telling the story of the rise and fall of Detroit's middle class. And of course, we're talking about this. We're recording this on the last week of July. As of today, I believe, a judge is going to decide whether or not Detroit can go forward by declaring bankruptcy and essentially shield themselves from or nullify the contracts that they have to provide pensions for Detroit's city workers. Let's first start with your piece. Tell us about the rise and fall of Detroit's middle class.
Well, Detroit's middle class rose because of the power of the auto industry, and by the 1940s, as unions began to pressure and civil rights groups began to pressure the auto industry to open their doors to African Americans, folks came to the city in big numbers because the jobs were unionized, they were secure, they offered good benefits, and for a time between the mid-1940s and the mid to late 1960s, the avenue for upward mobility for many, many black Detroiters was getting an assembly line job, even if those jobs weren't necessarily always the best in the auto industry. They were still jobs that offered good benefits and security. By the 1960s, those jobs were disappearing as the auto industry decentralized production and began to move to other parts of the United States and other parts of the world. And as those jobs disappeared, African-American workers began to lose that first rung on the ladder of economic mobility. But just at that moment, civil rights organizations and activists were pushing for the opening of jobs in the public sector for African Americans. And those jobs began to open up in a pretty big way over the course of the 1960s. And just
these
as
were
the
jobs,
auto industry is disappearing, and those public sector jobs provided a new basis of opportunity for Detroit's black population.
Now, of course, prior to that time, these jobs were simply not available to African Americans.
They started to be open gradually over the course of the period from the New Deal up until the 1960s, but it wasn't really until the 60s when civil rights groups put real pressure on local and state governments to hire African Americans, and blacks in Detroit especially started to become a really sizable share of the electorate. So they were, you know, they had the power of the vote to put pressure on the city to give them jobs. And then, of course, in the 70s, you have the implementation, with a great deal of controversy, of course, of affirmative action in public employment, and that opened up jobs, especially, say, in the fire department and the police department that had been pretty much all white reserves up through the 1960s.
And so we have a couple of factors happening simultaneously. Now, we should say that back in the, I guess it was in the 40s, in the 50s, the population of Detroit was something around 1.5 million, 1.8 million. How big was Detroit at that time?
Detroit peaked out probably a little less than 2 million. The 1950 census says 1.85 million. So a substantial population. By contrast, today it's about 700,000. So Detroit's lost in the ballpark of 1.25 million people in the last 60 years.
And in some respects, more importantly to the story of Detroit going bankrupt, either officially or not, is that the loss of those people also, I imagine, was inordinately wealthy people fleeing the city.
Absolutely. I mean, population flight proved to be devastating for the city's tax base. Property values, as the city witnessed disinvestment, went down, but there simply weren't as many property owners. And so the city, which relied, like most cities, heavily on property taxes, saw its coffers take a really big hit as people left the city, especially people with means.
And so we have a workforce that is city government, a municipal government workforce that is serving less and less people with less and less of a support for the infrastructure here. And I mean, one of the other things that strikes me about Detroit is its physical size is sort of unsustainable in some way.
Detroit is big. There are 139 square miles in the city, and that, you know, makes provision of public services, especially in an era of constraint, a real challenge. It takes a long time for, police officers or firefighters to get from the stations, which are understaffed, to the sites of incidents. So the size of the city matters. It's increasingly less dense, and in recent years the city has closed a lot of public schools as a way of trying to consolidate the population and to reduce the number of buildings online. But ultimately that's not the root cause of Detroit's financial crisis. It's really the gap between a city with a big poor and working class population and the loss in local tax revenues, but also it's really important to remember the loss of federal and state support to the city, which in the past was really important for public works, for employment, for education. And, you know, in the period since the 1960s, as cities started to lose clout in state legislatures and in Washington, we started seeing cuts. Those cuts were really deep in the 1980s when the federal share of urban spending dropped from about 12% to 3% in a 10-year period, beginning, you know, with Reagan's first term. So it's some of the problem is the lack of revenue locally. Some of it is the lack of support on the state and national level.
And so, what is it? I mean, what are the sort of the key factors that make Detroit different? I mean, because in some ways, it seems to me that Detroit is the story of Detroit is not terribly different than the story of America in many respects. It's just by a matter of degree. You know, I mean, one of the cities that I think about that had seemed to me to have a similar problem, although because it's not of such a large degree, but like a city like Hartford, Connecticut, for instance, where you've had a lot of population flight, particularly wealthy, to the suburbs, leaving Hartford without a tax base and therefore sort of unable to sort of dig itself out of sort of a spiraling down of the quality of life there and the quality of services. But what is it about Detroit that specifically made it so vulnerable in these many different ways? Was it just the loss of basically the car industry?
Well, the loss of car industry is crucial because it was the economic backbone of the city. It provided, you know, well-paying, secure jobs. It made it possible for lots of Detroiters to own their own homes. And the auto industry paid a lot into the city's tax coffers, too. And so having factories, having workers, both property and employment, provided a great deal of support for the city when the auto industry was at its peak. And as the auto industry moves elsewhere in search of cheap labor and different markets, that revenue to the city dries up. Other cities, say Philadelphia, for example, which is a big industrial city that's faced a lot of the problems that Detroit faced, saw its flight of capital happen in a more staggered way over a long period of time, which means you weren't placing all your eggs in one basket of one industry, but rather, you know, there were lots of industries and their timing was different, so the impact wasn't as profound as it was in Detroit, where, you know, as the old saying goes, when the auto industry sneezes, you know, Detroit and the region around it catch pneumonia. You know, it's a really serious dependent relationship between the city and the metro and the auto industry. But look, one of the other really big differences between Detroit and some other big cities is the intense hostility between the suburbs and outstate Michigan and the city of Detroit. I mean, to put it really bluntly, many rural Michigan legislators and their constituents, they see Detroit as the great Satan. They see Detroit as a place that is a cesspool of vice and crime and corruption. And there's a very much a racial inflection right there too. Detroit represents for many white Detroiters a place that was great until, quote, they took over, you know, meaning African Americans becoming the majority of the population and getting elected to the city council and of course, as mayor. And so many folks in Detroit blame the city's racial politics for its fate. And there's a lot to that. I mean, you needn't spend more than, you know, a few hours in Detroit or in Michigan to sense the really deep-rooted, seething hostility between city residents who think that the suburbs and the rest of the state are out to take away their self-determination, and suburbanites and rural Michigan residents who believe that Detroiters are out to pick their pockets and squander their hard-earned tax dollars in a way that's not going to benefit them. So it's a really intense situation there.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, there's some of that. I mean, it seems to me, as you know, even in New York State, there's some of that dynamic. But New York is just simply so powerful that it can sort of push back on that dynamic on some level. Some of the hostility, the upstate hostility towards downstate, but it seems to me that so much of that has to be in Michigan rooted in race and the sort of the inability of Detroit to be the power dynamic between Detroit and the rest of the state has changed dramatically, I imagine, since the days of having multiple auto factories in the city. I mean, you could almost probably track it in terms of like the direction in which the traffic flows on some level.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the striking things about visiting Detroit is how there really isn't much of a rush hour, if any at all. I mean, you can go down the major highways leading to downtown at 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning and get there just as quickly as you could at 1 or 2, and likewise coming home in the evening, it's usually a breeze going from downtown to outlying sections of the city or the suburbs. It's a reminder of how much the economy has taken a hit, and over a really long time, over the last 50 or 60 years.
Now, you wrote a book on the origins of urban crisis about Detroit. I guess almost 7-8 years ago now. And so this was obviously something that people were seeing. What was it? Were there any sort of major attempts to sort of stem this crisis, or was it simply just that there was not the political will or the political capacity, or could this, was this inevitable on some level?
It's hard not to see the current economic crisis as the inevitable consequence of, you know, half century plus of economic and political changes at work. But there have been efforts. Some in the 1970s, for example, the mayor then, Coleman Young, the first black mayor, built very close working relationships with the big three. Auto industry attempted to lure them back into the city, gave significant subsidies for the construction of a couple of big plants in the city, built or oversaw the building of the Renaissance Center, a big downtown hotel, office, retail complex meant to attract suburbanites and their dollars in. In the 90s, the city embarked on a pretty ambitious downtown redevelopment scheme, and in the 2000s, the city's been putting a lot of its energy into casinos and also into kind of hipster gentrification, with hopes that attracting some young cultural producers to the center of the city will spark a revitalization. But these were all, unfortunately, really small scale compared to the scope of the problems that Detroit was facing. And so many of them were based, especially the stuff in the 90s and the 2000s, the casinos and gentrification, based on the dubious assumption that somehow the benefits of having some, you know, wine bars and good restaurants in downtown was going to trickle down to the you know, 600,000 or so African Americans living in the city, most of whom are working class, lower middle class, or poor, and we just haven't seen that kind of, you know, trickle down benefit from having some hipsters sipping lattes and going to art galleries, despite the kind of zeal that surrounded that whole process.
And I mean, I want to talk about what has to happen next, but before we do, one of the issues that has the most relevance from a national perspective is this question of whether or not the city can actually file for bankruptcy, and particularly whether or not it can reduce the pensions of about 30,000 current and retired workers as a way of easing the near $20 billion worth of debt the city has. This is going to have implications, or at the very least, we know that there's cities around the country and pension funds around the country and employee unions around the country who are looking at this, because this could very well become a precedent. First off, I mean, what can we say about these people now who are dependent on the city for a pension? Either they've been working towards this for 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, or those who are now retired and need these pensions to live. My understanding is, and I'm not 100% sure about this, but in general, city workers do not get Social Security because presumably they're getting their pension. And we're talking about pensions, right? If I'm not mistaken, that are around, on average, about $30,000 a year. So nobody's living the high life, per se, on these type of pensions. So how does this shake out?
Cutting back the pensions is going to be devastating, right? It's police and firefighters, on average, have the highest pensions in around 30, but a lot of city employees have significantly lower pensions, you know, in the around the 20,000, 19,000-20,000 range. So let's take the hypothetical that we cut, I don't know, 25% of those pensions as a way of dealing with that, and that's a pretty conservative estimate. You know, we're looking at folks making somewhere between 15 and, you know, $24,000 a year. That'd be devastating for retirees who rely on this income that they worked toward and negotiated and expected as part of their contract with the city. It'd be devastating for them. It's going to take people who are already living, you know, in at least modest comfort and put them over the edge of real precarity. And that's perhaps the most worrisome aspect of the bankruptcy, is what's going to happen to those 20, 30,000 folks who are not living rich off of the pensions that they had expected.
And presumably, you know, these people haven't built up any Social Security because their city pensions supplanted it. But I would also imagine that if you cut the purchasing power of 30,000 people, or I don't know how many retirees we're talking about exactly, you know, use that money. You know, nobody's socking this money away when you're making that kind of money. You're going out and spending it. And so that means for every dollar that you cut from these people's pension, you're also essentially pulling probably a multiplier of that dollar. I don't know what the multiplier would be. Maybe it's a dollar and a quarter. Maybe it's a dollar 30. We don't know how far a dollar travels necessarily in Detroit, but it's certainly a dollar or more from the local economy, which should continue, which will then affect tax revenues, right? And then this becomes a downward cycle at that point.
Definitely. I mean, one thing to be said, though, is that, you know, not all the retirees are living in Detroit. Some are in Florida. Some are, you know, on their summer cottages in northern Michigan. They live in places other than Detroit. But just focusing on that subset who live in Detroit, losing that modest buying power that they have is not going to be very good for Detroit's staggering economy.
And so what are we looking at in terms of any type of potential for solving this crisis. I mean, short of, I mean, you know, it's a classic battle between who's going to take the pain here. The guy who worked as sanitation worker for 20 years in Detroit, or the guy who worked as a cop or a teacher or a bondholder, I guess. Is there any, I mean, I would imagine it's unlikely, but I mean, really what's needed here is some type of federal bailout, is it not?
Well, a bailout would be ideal, and, you know, it would be imaginable in a different political climate. But right now, we have a president who isn't going to go near there for fear of political backlash, and we have a Congress that has, especially in the House, has zero interest in sending even a penny, a pittance to Detroit. So I think a bailout would be the fair and just response, but I think it's pretty unlikely given the current political climate. So what we have to hope for is that those representing the pensioners in the deliberation and probably litigation that ensues over the next few years can make as strong a case as possible, and that the judge assigned to handle the bankruptcy case recognizes that giving a haircut to municipal bondholders is not going to have the same immediate life-changing effect as lobbing even 10 or 20 or 30% off of the monthly pension checks of Detroit's retired employees. And their interests have to be at the table.
Do you see any way out for Detroit at this point? I mean, if I was Governor Snyder, you know, God forgive me, and I was to put you in charge as the emergency manager of the city, and gave you full authority to do whatever you wanted, what would you do? I mean, presuming that there's not going to be any type of federal funds, I mean, what would the steps that you would take if there was any? Or would you simply say, no, thank you, I don't want that job because there's nothing to be done?
If I were Governor Snyder, I would go to the Michigan State Legislature and I would say, there are lots of theories about Detroit's problems, but both of us, Democrats and Republicans, here in the state capitol, bear some responsibility both for causing it and now for helping Detroit out. And I would make a case that it's imperative, morally imperative, that the state legislature do something. Of course, I'm not Governor Snyder, and he's not going to do it, and the state legislature is not going to, wouldn't go along with it even if he did. So that leaves us with what happens from the perspective of the emergency manager and those involved in the complicated negotiations over bankruptcy. And I would say, were I at the table, I would say, leave the pensioners alone. Touch as little or none of the meager amount of money that's going to them. It's gonna mean giving a bigger haircut to the municipal bondholders and to the financial institutions that made bets on Detroit's municipal bonds, and they went into it as risk takers. And sometimes when you take risks, you lose. Whereas the city employees took the jobs with the full expectation that they would end up with pensions and a comfortable retirement. They weren't going in there gambling in a way that bondholders were. And I think there's got to be some proportionality in terms of how much risk versus how much obligation the city has to right. the various stakeholders.
That's the whole theory behind lending, right? And that's why you get an interest rate on it, because presumably it's pricing in the risk. Thomas Seguro, thank you so much for joining us. We will link to your book, The Origins of the Urban Crisis, and to your piece in The New Yorker. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Sam. Good talking. It hit me like
So joining us now from Netroots Nation 2013 is Carol Linnett. She is the site manager and director of research of, well, you've heard of DeSmog Blog, but this is DeSmog Blog Canada, or DeSmog Canada. What's the URL for that, Carol?
It's dsmog.ca.
dsmog.ca. All right, so, Carol, one of the things that we were just talking briefly about, and I want to hear more about this, is a big trade deal that's taking place between, or being negotiated between Canada and China. And this is happening at a time where in this country there's a massive trade deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is very problematic based on many of the things from NAFTA, which have been problems for both Canadians and Americans regarding, you know, the corporate sort of transcendence of corporate law over sort of sovereign laws of countries, whether environmental or labor regulations or consumer. So tell us about this this trade deal between Canada and China.
So this trade deal is similar to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP, in a way, except for this one sort of emphasizes just the relationship between Canada and China. So it's called the Foreign Investment Promotion and Protection Agreement, or FIPA. It's also called the China-Canada Trade Agreement. And so it's very similar in the sense that it sort of introduces this excessive corporate rights into the legal and political landscape. And it's incredibly significant and important for environmental legislation, as you were saying, and for labor rights. And also it sort of puts this pressure on governments of all levels, whether it's municipal all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada, to keep in mind certain investor rights and the protection of investor interests, sometimes that, you know, perhaps could conflict or compete with the government's own responsibility to its citizens. And this also includes First Nations in Canada. And in Canada, First Nations people have a special constitutional set of rights. And there's a lot of concern, and actually even legal recourse that's happening right now to sort of prevent the ratification of this agreement by First Nations people, who are saying, we know this trade agreement will affect First Nations rights. First Nations rights haven't been addressed well enough in Canada already, and now you're introducing this sense of competing Chinese investor rights, and we don't think that that's safe or that's productive. And so there's been some tremendous pushback in Canada.
It seems to me, the sort of the new paradigm for these trade agreements, and part of which came out of NAFTA. And we've seen, I think, numerous cases where American corporations are basically making Canada pay cash for having regulations that somehow impede their ability to make profit.
And that's already at $160 million paid, with $5 billion additional dollars pending. Canada is one of the most highly sued countries under trade agreement laws in the developed world.
And not coincidentally, probably also has greater protections for their environment, for their labor and their consumers, and that's basically it. They've got to pay because they are those manifestations of the will of the people of Canada impedes the profit-making desires of these corporations.
And there's more to it than that in Canada, which is interesting, because the context in which this trade agreement came to light, and this was a trade agreement that was signed in secret in Russia, and people sort of found out about it a month after the fact.
A month after it was signed?
Signed, but not ratified.
Okay.
So the sort of terms
and
of
it was
the
clearly negotiated in total
clearly
secret.
Negotiated, a tremendously enormous document, but people felt like they had not been consulted or even forewarned. It had been signed in Russia by Prime Minister Stephen Harper in September. And it wasn't until about October when people started to get word that this had happened. But it has yet to be ratified. But the context sort of leading up to that was that we had last year, throughout the spring and the summer, we had some sort of massive legislative changes to our environmental laws. And a lot of people say, you know, the way to understand these changes in our environmental laws and certain things, water protection, species protection, habitat protection, really is best understood when you're looking at the current government's plans to sort of scale up energy development and energy infrastructure. And these are things that can take a lot of time when you're doing massive environmental reviews, for example, of a pipeline. And so a lot of people say these legislative changes came in to sort of facilitate or expedite energy development and infrastructure. So when you're thinking about this China-Canada investment treaty coming in after our environmental laws have been dropped to a very low level, that means that even in the future, say opposition governments are the majority government and they want to reinstitute those environmental laws, they will be under the threat of tremendous international legal recourse from China in these international investment tribunals where these
trade lawyers
will
together
be fighting
and say,
over saying, Canada, you don't have the right to actually protect your lakes anymore, and because it's going to affect the bottom line of our Chinese investors. And so that puts Canadians in a real bind. We're putting ourselves in a pretty precarious position.
Where essentially you would have to pay to protect your natural resources in the future if you were still bound by this negotiation with China, where essentially their corporations, which project profits based upon the low level of consumer, environmental or labor protections of their country, then get projected onto Canada. I mean, it's a huge loss of sovereignty, which is generally the bailiwick of the right. But in this instance, they seem to be okay as long as they're not giving up their sovereignty to people in blue helmets, but rather corporate lawyers.
Right. There seems to be a sort of second standard when it comes to corporations, and especially those in massive sort of energy industry.
So Carol, we just have 1 minute left. What is happening in Canada to push back on this?
So we've got some major pushback from some citizens groups and grassroots groups and First Nations groups. So if anybody's interested in finding out more about this pushback, they can check out petitions with leadnow.ca and also someofus.org. They're two groups who are organizing to find, you know, the pushback against this and inform people about the legal implications of this so that there's some expression of political will generally to sort of fight the ratification of this agreement.
Can people find out more information about the document itself that has been signed? I mean, I imagine that is now public.
Yeah, it is. And if you Google Canada, China, FIPA, F-I-P-A, you will come across a lot of articles and a lot of information and government websites that have the actual document available.
I imagine that's pretty instructive. If people, the TPP has obviously been negotiated in secret. There's only been a couple of chapters of this that have been leaked. So, but I imagine that people could check out that Chinese-Canadian trade accord and get a sense of what may be in the TPP. So just as a point of reference. But
that's a great point.
Carol Linnett, the site manager and director of research for DeSmog Canada at DeSmog.ca. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.